We're into chapter 24, Gnosis and Anana, published first on 15 November 1917, and about 15 years later, substantially revised. We pick it up with this paragraph. Therefore, the truth soul does not arrive at self-oblivion in the infinite. It comes to an eternal self-possession in the infinite. So this is an affirmation of real being. This is not the striking off of finitude and immersion into something unnameable, which is the end of many yogic paths, paths of sadhana. Rather, this is the infinite possessing itself in limitless being. He continues, its action is not irregular. It is a perfect control in an infinite freedom. In the lower planes, the soul is naturally subject to nature, and the regulating principle is found in the lower nature. All regulation there depends on the acceptance of a strict subjection to the law of the finite. So, as the true being has allowed itself to enter into relationships with all manner of planes of being, from the highest to the lowest, at each plane, Purusha and Prakriti have a different conversation. Here, at the Gnostic level, it is one and the same. Spirit and nature are not different. They are not opposed. They are not distinct. And they are equally regent. But in the lower planes, the ones in which we typically dwell, nature is allowed to lead, and Purusha is in allegiance to her demand. If the soul on these planes withdraws from that law into the liberty of the infinite, it loses its natural center and becomes centerless in a cosmic infinitude. It forfeits the living harmonic principle by which its external being was till then regulated, and it finds no other. So this explains to the psychologist why, when we experience from one of these lower modes of being, whether we enter in our physical consciousness into a sense of the opened magnitudes of the cosmic and to that which extends beyond the physical, if we open ourselves to the oceans of life force, or indeed the luminosities of the mind, and enter into what is the spiritual reality from those planes, we lose the key to self as fixed in the whole, as fixed in the infinite. For us to harmonize all these three states of being, the transcendence, the universality, and the true individuality, which should be the fruit of our final experiences and success in sadhana, that is a reach that we can afford to impose upon nature only when we get to that. Otherwise, entering into the spiritual freedom at any one of these nodes can cause us, in a sense, to blank out. The personal nature, or what is left of it, merely continues mechanically for a while its past movements, or it dances in the gusts and falls of the universal energy that acts on the individual system rather than in that system, or it strays in the wild steps of an irresponsible ecstasy, or it remains inert and abandoned by the breath of the spirit that was in it. So he's touched upon all three things here: the nature of our true being, the nature of consciousness affecting itself, and what is our experience of it. In a sense, without stating it so much, this is a critique of the spirituality of the last two millenniums, because they have not arrived at a change of the personal, the social, or the cosmic nature. They have left things pretty much as they are, exalting the individual into a sense of infinite freedom, but without any consequent power to change anything about the world that we experience. The personal nature, or what is left of it, merely continues mechanically for a while its past movements. Oh, I just read that, pardon me. If, on the other hand, the soul moves in its impulse of freedom towards the discovery of another and divine center of control through which the infinite can consciously govern its own action in the individual, it is moving towards the gnosis where that center pre-exists, the center of an eternal harmony and order. It is when he ascends above mind and life to the gnosis that the Purusha becomes the master of his own nature, because subject only to supreme nature. So he's left the dichotomy, which is prevalent all the way to the topmost ranges of the mind, where Purusha and Prakriti are in a sense dichotomized and opposed to each other, and arrived at that unitive state of consciousness above, which is Gnostic. That is, it truly knows. It knows by identity and knows that nature is not different from the soul that sees it. So, from Prakriti to Paraprakriti, from Purusha, really, to Ishvara, Lord with, at one with, Shakti. For there, force or will is the exact counterpart, the perfect dynamis of the divine knowledge. Remember, no difference. One is the flow of the other. And that knowledge is not merely the eye of the witness, Sakshi, Purusha. It is the immanent and compelling gaze of the Ishvara. Immanent because he's in all, and all is in him, or all is in her. Perhaps it is Ishvari. It's luminous, governing power, a power not to be hedged in or denied, imposes its self-expressive force on all the action and makes true and radiant and authentic and inevitable every movement and impulse. So here we get back to the shades of Vedic knowledge of this supramental consciousness. True and radiant and authentic and inevitable. All of it, satyam ritam brahat. It is true. It is the truth of being expressed as truth. It is ordered, harmonic, but full of conscious force, and it is vast in its vision and its reach. It is not limited. If it stands in individuality, if it takes that individual pose, it's still contextualized in the whole, in all of it, harmonized in the heart of oneness. The gnosis does not reject the realizations of the lower planes, for it is not an annihilation or extinction, not a nirvana, but a sublime fulfillment of our manifested nature. It possesses the first realizations under its own conditions after it has transformed them and made them elements of a divine order, rhythm again. So the fruit of the experience, the release into what in one path might be called nirvana, in another might be called moksha, these releases from confinement to the ego, confinement to the form, are in the Gnostic nature empowered. They fulfill nature and do not deny nature. And now we enter something interesting here. The Gnostic soul is the child, but the king child. Here is the royal and eternal childhood whose toys are the worlds, and all universal nature is the miraculous garden of the play that never, of the play that tires never. That deserves to be read well. Let me try again. The Gnostic soul is the child, but the king child. Here is the royal and eternal childhood whose toys are the worlds, and all universal nature is the miraculous garden of the play that tires never. There's a footnote. 2. So, Heraclitus, the kingdom is of the child. This, of course, appeared a few months earlier in the Aria, in Volume 3, June 1917, in the seventh and last essay that he wrote about Heraclitus, the great and our favorite pre-Socratic philosopher. Here's the fragment, which was captured from the scattered works of Heraclitus after his passing. It's a quote. A lifetime is a child at play, moving pieces in a game. The kingdom belongs to the child. Sri Aurobindo noted in that last essay, about Heraclitus. This little section. We have too his saying, thou canst not find the limits of the soul. And we have the profoundest of all Heraclitus's utterances, the kingdom is of the child. If man is in his real being an infinite and immortal spirit, there is surely no reason why he should not awaken to his immortality, arise towards the consciousness of the universal, one and absolute, live in a higher self-realization. Quote, I have sought for myself, end quote, says Heraclitus. And what was it that he found? You find adumbrated in Heraclitus many of the teachings with which we're familiar in Buddhism. You cannot step twice into the same river. All things are at war. Heraclitus saw the transience, but saw that in which the transience sits or stands. Saw, felt, realized the immortality of the spirit. You might know that Diogenes left us one thought about Heraclitus. They say, this is a quote, they say that Euripides, the great Greek tragedian, gave Socrates a copy of Heraclitus's book and asked him what he thought of it. Socrates replied, "What I understand is splendid. And I think that what I don't understand is also splendid. But it would take a Daedalian to get to the bottom of it." Well, we're playing with this idea about the Gnostic soul being the child, and you'll remember Sri Aurobindo's famous aphorism, which says, "What is God after all? An eternal child playing an eternal game in an eternal garden." This he wrote in a section he called Delight of Being in his Aphorisms and Thoughts and Glimpses. And that appeared a couple of years earlier in the first volume of the Aria, 15 May, 1915. So, this idea of the divine playing with the elements of the world, never aging, always youthful, is redolent throughout literature, East and West, but Sri Aurobindo has captured it perfectly in that one thought phrase. So, we continue. The gnosis takes up the condition of divine inertia. But this is no longer the inertia of the subject soul, driven by nature like a fallen leaf in the breath of the Lord. It is the happy passivity bearing an unimaginable intensity of action and ananda of the nature soul, at once driven by the bliss of the mastering Purusha and aware of herself as the supreme Shakti above and around him, and mastering and carrying him blissfully on her bosom forever. This biune being of Purusha Prakriti is as if a flaming sun and body of divine light, self-carried in its orbit by its own inner consciousness and power, at one with the universal, at one with the supreme transcendence. A flaming sun and body of divine light, perhaps a savitri. Its madness is a wise madness of ananda, The incalculable ecstasy of a supreme consciousness and power, vibrating with an infinite sense of freedom and intensity in its divine life movements. Its action is suprarational, and therefore to the rational mind, which has not the key, it seems a colossal madness. And yet, this that seems madness is a wisdom in action that only baffles the mind by the liberty and richness of its contents, and the infinite complexity and fundamental simplicity of its motions. It is the very method of the Lord of the worlds, a thing no intellectual interpretation can fathom. A dance, this also, a whirl of mighty energies, but the master of the dance holds the hands of his energies and keeps them to the rhythmic order, the self-traced harmonic circles of his rasa lila. The Gnostic soul is not bound any more than the divine demoniac by the petty conventions and proprieties of the normal human life, or the narrow rules through which it makes some shift to accommodate itself with the perplexing dualities of the lower nature, and tries to guide its steps among the seeming contradictions of the world, to avoid its numberless stumbling blocks, and to foot with gingerly care around its dangers and pitfalls. The Gnostic supramental life is abnormal to us because it is free to all the hardihoods and audacious delights of a soul dealing fearlessly and even violently with nature. And yet is it the very normality of the infinite, and all governed by the law of the truth in its exact unerring process. One can be forceful with oneself when one lives in that consciousness. One is not in domination or tyranny over another. It obeys the law of a self-possessed knowledge, love, delight in an innumerable oneness. It seems abnormal only because its rhythm is not measurable by the faltering beats of the mind, but yet it steps in a wonderful and transcendent measure. You'll remember Sri Aurobindo's admonition to the seeker after the Divine Mother that you cannot fathom her, her movements, her thoughts, nothing about her. This is also recorded in the Taittiriya Upanishad. The mind, attempting to reach that, falls back baffled. But what, then, is the necessity of a still higher step? And what difference is there between the soul in gnosis and the soul in the bliss? And this again goes to the Taittiriya, which is the best record we have of the layering of these plateaus of being as they rise in the cosmic staircase. There is no essential difference, but yet a difference, because there is a transfer to another consciousness and a certain reversal in position. For at each step of the ascent from matter to the highest existence, there is a reversal of consciousness. The soul no longer looks up to something beyond it, but is in it, and from it looks down on all that it was before. This implies inclusion as well as elevation. As one grows in height, one also grows and expands. And one grows, you might say, downwards. One never leaves anything behind in the powers of the spirit, whence reaching the gnosis. From then on, all is expansive. Here we get to the real meaning of what is Brahman, from br, to grow, to expand, to dynamize, to become great, to speak the true word, which truly creates. The soul, let's read it again, no longer looks up to something beyond it, but is in it, and from it looks down on all that it was before. On all planes, indeed, the Ananda can be discovered because everywhere it exists and is the same. From delight all things are born. In delight all things continue. Into delight all things pass, and they're going hence. Again, the Taittiriya Upanishad. It is a universal and omnipresent truth. But even there is a repetition of the Ananda plane in each lower world of consciousness, because all facets of being, all features of the divine, are implicated, are suggested, and really deposited completely on every plane. Simply, each posture of every plane brings forward a different element in the relationship of soul and nature, either in union or in differentiation or in apparent distinctness. But in the lower planes, not only is it reached by a sort of dissolution into it of the pure mind or the life sense or the physical awareness, but it is, as it were, itself diluted by the dissolved form of mind, life, or matter, held in the dilution and turned into a poor thinness, wonderful to the lower consciousness, but not comparable to its true intensities. So, one can experience Ananda at any level, true, but you experience it in a sense as a tincture in a large container. The gnosis has, on the contrary, a dense light of essential consciousness, chidgana, in which the intense fullness of the Ananda can be. So we have gone beyond the plane of the mind when we become Gnostic, and there consciousness, Satchit Ananda, Eschit, has massed itself. This is tapas, compressing itself. This is the gathered consciousness, Chidgana, Chaitanya Gana, which he refers to here, in which the intense fullness of the Ananda can be. So from there one can enter in to the infinity that is Ananda, as one can enter into the infinity of consciousness seated in the infinity of true being without being lost in the experience, because all the draperies have been drawn open and the soul can enter without reliance upon form into the fullness of what is Satchit Ananda is expressed in this Gnostic consciousness. And when the form of gnosis dissolved into the Ananda, it is not annulled altogether, but undergoes a natural change by which the soul is carried up into its last and absolute freedom. For it casts itself into the absolute existence of the spirit and is enlarged into its own entirely self-existent bliss infinitudes. The gnosis has the infinite and absolute as the conscious source, accompaniment, condition, standard, field, and atmosphere of all its activities. It possesses it as its base, fount, constituent material, indwelling, and inspiring presence. but in its action, it seems to stand out from it as its operation, as the rhythmical working of its activities, as a divine maya, or wisdom formation of the eternal. And his note, not in the sense of illusion, but in the original Vedic significance of the word maya, all in the Gnostic existence is real, spiritually concrete, eternally verifiable. So maya here is not trickery. It is how the infinite measures itself out into limited finite form without losing its infinity. If there is magic, that's the magic. That one can become universal, one can become individual, one can remain sheerly the transcendent, and none of it be a false footing. All of it is true and well-founded and can become the whole dance of the divine. Gnosis is the divine knowledge will of the divine consciousness force. Now we'll pause for a moment and note that we've said this before, that Satchit Ananda, seen as Chit Shakti, extends itself into the supramental consciousness, the Gnostic consciousness, as knowledge will. And there, in Gnosis, they are not separate. Knowledge and will are the same thing. It is harmonic consciousness and action of Prakriti Purusha, full of the delight of the divine existence. In the Ananda, the knowledge goes back from these willed harmonies into pure self-consciousness. The will dissolves into pure transcendent force, and both are taken up into the pure delight of the infinite. The basis of the Gnostic existence is the self-stuff and self-form of the Ananda. Remember, in the Taittiriya, it is Ananda that is creative. That is what is the centerpiece, has the key mission to create, to cast out into multiple stations the realities that it contains within itself. If Ananda does not wish to dance, nothing happens. It's interesting that he's sticking here with the terms Purusha and Prakriti. He's not bringing in, clearly, he could, Ishvara, Ishvari, Ishvara, Shakti, none of these, because we have been dealing with the nomenclature of Purusha, Prakriti in the Sankhya system, and he's sticking with that for his basic vocabulary. But you can see that he's stretching, and the Sankhya terminology is being stretched to its extreme. In the Ananda, the knowledge goes back from these willed harmonies into pure self-consciousness. The will dissolves into pure transcendent force, and both are taken up into the pure delight of the infinite. The basis of the Gnostic existence is the self-stuff and self-form of the Ananda. This, in the ascension, takes place because there is here completed the transition to the absolute unity, of which the Gnosis is the decisive step, but not the final resting place. In the gnosis, the soul is aware of its infinity and lives in it. Yet it lives also in a working center for the individual play of the infinite. This is worth noting. Even in The Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo is not quite so succinct in his expression about this. It realizes its identity with all existences, but it keeps a distinction without difference, by which it can have also the contact with them in a certain diverseness. This is that distinction for the joy of contact, which in the mind becomes not only difference, but in itself experience division from our other selves, in its spiritual being, a sense of loss of self, one with us and others, and a reaching after the felicity it has forfeited. In life, a compromise between egoistic self-absorption and a blind seeking out for the lost oneness. In its infinite consciousness, the Gnostic soul creates a sort of voluntary limitation for its own wisdom purposes. It has even its particular luminous aura of being in which it moves, although beyond that, it enters into all things and identifies itself with all being and all existences. Now, this makes perfect sense if we see that the supramental consciousness, the Gnostic awareness, based on identity of being, consciously held, wishes to establish itself as a diversity, the many inside of the one, but truly stationed there. If that were not so, we would not have the primary, the secondary, and the tertiary poises of the supramental. That tertiary poise, where the individual comes to the front within the context, not divorced from the transcendent, is the whole point of that exercise, and why Satchit Ananda wants to express itself so. But back to this. I think, did we, pardon me, in the Ananda, all is reversed. The center disappears. So that tertiary poise in which the individual becomes prominent, that center is gone. In the bliss nature, there is no center, nor any voluntary or imposed circumference, but all is, all are one equal being, one identical spirit. The bliss soul finds and feels itself everywhere. It has no mansion, is aniketa, without a house, houseless, or has the all for its mansion, or, if it likes, it has all things for its many mansions, open to each other forever. So this is truly the vastness of being. All other selves are entirely its own selves, in action as well as in essence. So you see, there is that bridge beyond of a flow of oneness in the Ananda that is not there in the supramental. The joy of contact in diverse oneness becomes altogether the joy of absolute identity in innumerable oneness. Existence is no longer formulated in the terms of the knowledge, because the known and knowledge and the knower are wholly one self here. And since all possesses all in an intimate identity beyond the closest closeness, There is no need of what we call knowledge. And the Gnostic being is all about knowledge. Yes. All the consciousness is of the bliss of the infinite. All power is power of the bliss of the infinite. All forms and activities are forms and activities of the bliss of the infinite. In this absolute truth of its being, the eternal soul of Ananda lives. Here, deformed by contrary phenomena, there, brought back and transfigured into their reality. So next week, we touch upon the Rig Veda as well as the Taittiriya in our reading of this. It's a good place, I think, to put a bookmark. Savitri, continuing the passage that we were in last week, in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirits, Freedom and Greatness, we're on page 90, I think, as we begin. A grand solution closed the long impasse, in which the heights of mortal effort end. A reconciling wisdom looked on life. It took the striving undertones of mind, and took the confused refrain of human hopes, and made of them a sweet and happy call. It lifted from an underground of pain the inarticulate murmur of our lives, and found for it a sense illimitable, a mighty oneness, its perpetual theme. It caught the soul's faint scattered utterances, read hardly twixt our lines of rigid thought, or mid this drowse and coma on matter's breast, heard like disjointed mutterings in sleep. It grouped the golden links that they had lost and showed to them their divine unity, saving from the error of divided self the deep spiritual cry in all that is. All the great words that toiled to express the one were lifted into an absoluteness of light, an ever-burning revelation's fire, and the immortality of the eternal voice. There was no quarrel more of truth with truth. The endless chapter of their differences, retold in light by an omniscient scribe, traveled through difference towards unity. Mind's winding search lost every tinge of doubt, led to its end by an all-seeing speech that garbed the initial and original thought with a finality of an ultimate phrase. United were time's creative mood and tense to the style and syntax of identity. A paean swelled from the lost musing deeps, an anthem pealed to the triune ecstasies, a cry of the moments to the immortal's bliss. As if the strophes of a cosmic ode, a hierarchy of climbing harmonies, peopled with voices and with visages, aspired in a crescendo of the gods from matter's abysses to the spirit's peaks. Above were the immortals' changeless seats, white chambers of dalliance with eternity, and the stupendous gates of the alone. Across the unfolding of the seas of self appeared the deathless countries of the One. A many-miracled consciousness unrolled vast aim and process and unfettered norms, a larger nature's great familiar rose. A franchise from the net of earthly sense, calm continents of potency were glimpsed. Homelands of beauty shut to human eyes, half seen at first through wonder's gleaming lids, surprised the vision with felicity. Sunbelts of knowledge, moonbelts of delight, stretched out in an ecstasy of widenesses beyond our indigent corporeal range. There he could enter, there a while abide. A voyager upon uncharted routes, fronting the viewless danger of the unknown, adventuring across enormous realms, he broke into another space and time. That would conclude book one. I thank you for your patience tonight. I have tried you. Much love to you all. I do look forward to seeing you again. Stay well in the meantime. All the very best. Live in mother's delight. Be happy. Namaste. Jai Ma.